Very good morning. How are you this morning?
Good morning. Very good, thank you. How are you guys?
Very good. This is David Arkell from 360 Energy.
Hi, Dave.
So, Perry, thank you so much for allowing us the opportunity to speak to you. And before we start, I wanted to make sure you understand who we are and what we do in business so you have a good depth of where we're coming from. So we're an energy consulting firm. And we've been in business actually since 1995. Our target market, the markets that we serve, are manufacturing, municipalities, and greenhouses. So quite a diverse group. Our role when we work with customers is to assist them to optimize their energy costs. So we do that two ways. We do it from how they can procure energy differently or more effectively. And we also look at ways for them to reduce their consumption of data internally as well. So I've got the questions in front of me here. Just if you could be so kind to sort of explain your brief background and the research and interests you have regarding energy and energy management, if you could share that with us.
Okay. Well, my interests are in business issues related to energy, the natural environment, and financial markets. So any one of those or intersection of those types of topics are typically what I'm interested in. I have several projects that I'm working on right now, which you probably are aware of. I'm interested in energy usage in emerging economies and comparing that to energy usage in developed economies. And we're looking at, obviously energy usage tends to correlate very high with GDP growth and CO2 emissions, so the three of those tend to be highly correlated. And for an emerging economy, if it's growing rapidly, it's going to be using a lot of energy and producing a lot of CO2. So the question is, you know, if a country, if we had a recommendation for that, could we reduce energy consumption to a point we can, but then we get into topics of fuel switching, and there's a whole issue about displacement. How easy is it to displace fossil fuels? And renewable energy. So that's one area that I'm working in and have an active interest. I'm also interested in energy trading and risk management, particularly with financialization of commodities. An average individual investor today can buy almost any sort of product that will mimic a major commodity price. I'm mostly interested in the energies. But that brings up the question from an investment perspective, whether or not an investor should really, have things like oil and gold and things like that in their investment portfolio. So I have interest in that area. And then more probably towards what your company is actually specializing in, I'm interested in sustainable business models. And so that would be, as I mentioned, sort of benchmarking and doing external audits and trying to find out what, one could recommend to, say, a business with respect to their energy usage. So those are the sorts of things that I'm currently working on, and those are pretty much characteristic of my interests over the past 20 years.
So one last thing before I go through these questions is one thing that we do that is unique from other people is, remember I talked about this procurement, which you're involved in, and the usage. Typically in our industry, those are siloed. So you have someone who specializes in procurement who approaches a company, and then you have an engineering outfit that approaches them on usage, and the two shall never cross. Mm. We think that's a mistake because that information should be fed to either party, whether the financial person should understand the usage and the usage person should get the price signals. And that typically isn't done. So in our programming, we try to incorporate that so it integrates.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely essential. I totally agree with you. The siloization within companies tends to be very obvious when you talk about things like energy, and you're right. I mean, you can talk to somebody who's an end-of-pipe person saying, look, this is what we can do, and someone else just two doors down has no clue what's going on and probably doesn't even care. So part of it's trying to build an integrated energy strategy. Now, the thing about business is that when you talk to companies, as you well know, they say, well, okay, so what is this going to do for me on the bottom line? And then you sort of leapfrog a lot of the intermediate type steps, and someone says, well, so what exactly does this do for our revenues or our cost structure? With an integrated process, I think it's easier to answer those kinds of questions, but you kind of have to be aware that different people from the organization kind of ask you direct questions, which, at first are not really questions you think are really all that interesting, but they do. So.
Now, I'm moving to question two, Perry. And actually, one of our engineers that does work for us. He actually heard you on CBC. I unfortunately didn't get a chance to hear.
Oh.
So
okay.
you were recently interviewed on CBC surrounding the Ontario carbon regulations that the government is looking to implement. So for those who didn't see the interview, I guess ultimately we're going to say, can you provide a synopsis of your thoughts on the government's current direction? Can you give us a sort of, it may have changed even since that interview.
No, but I can give you a better answer, I think, because,
okay.
We're not squeezed in between. That was the, that day was the opening day for the Blue Jays here in Toronto. So, I mean, the big story was Blue Jays home opener, right? And, oh, by the way, there's carbon trading coming, too. We snuck that in. And then the next day, we're going to sell off part of OPG. Oh, that snuck in, too. But, you know, the big thing was what happened to the Blue Jays.
Yes.
Right. Well, look, if we go back to... Ontario has established a Green Energy Act. They established that in 2009, and the first part of that act was really about increasing the amount of renewable energy going into the electricity generation. And they've done that. We have more renewables being added to the generation capacity. We've gotten rid of the coal-fired power plants. And last October, the Ontario government issued its first green bond, which is a really, I think, a great idea. And so now they've moved on to the pricing of carbon. And when you talk about the pricing of carbon, you have basically two avenues you can take. One is the cap and trade, which is what our premier said she's going to pursue. And the other is the carbon tax, which is what British Columbia has done. So... carbon pricing is a natural extension of the Ontario government's long-term sustainable plan. So it fits in perfectly with what they're doing, and I'm happy that they're going to be doing that. Now, as I'm sure you know, the carbon trading situation, well, there's positives and negatives there because Ontario is going to sign on with Quebec, who has already been trading carbon for 2 years. Quebec has signed on with California, who's also been trading for 2 years, and so these three jurisdictions will have a joint carbon trading. And, in principle, the cap and trade sounds good. You know, the government puts on a cap, they distribute allowances for carbon emissions to businesses, the heavy polluters, and then, you know, any business that exceeds their allocation of carbon quotas has to go to the market and buy extra. Those companies that are good and efficient can sell. You have a market, business is happy because they have a marketplace where they can go and trade carbon. Now, what I said was, well, yeah, that's the idea in theory, but the European Union has showed us there's all sorts of problems with carbon trading and there's all sorts of loopholes. And, the information from carbon trading in Europe is not overly supportive that there's been a big drop in carbon emissions. And, then you contrast with British Columbia and you say, well, let's just tax it, right?
Yes.
So that's basically what I was passing on. So I like the idea in principle. It definitely fits with the Ontario government's long-term sustainability goals. You know, the question is, how is this thing going to be set up? And I think, David, you added some questions to the list, and I can sort of go down the list there. I mean, what are sort of the big influences in cap and trade? Well, the big issues are the government has to set this up so that there's a cap that actually means something. Then they have to decide what the industry coverage is going to be. In other words, which companies are going to be regulated by the cap. And then there's this messy issue of the allocation of the emission permits. And in order to not scare everybody off, typically the permits are given away for free in the first couple years. And if you look at Europe right now, carbon is trading for about 7 euros per metric ton. California is about $11 per ton, metric ton. Quebec is about $15 per metric ton. And over in BC, the carbon tax is about $30 per metric ton. And all of these prices, I think, are far too low to have any meaningful impact. So you can see that just from the comparison I gave you, the highest carbon price actually is in BC that has a tax, and the emissions trading regions tend to have very underpriced carbon prices, and they doesn't have much of an impact. You've got to get to about $50 per ton before you really have any bite to this.
I find this so intriguing. So let's if we could, I'm going to shoot some questions based on what you've just said.
Sure.
So what are the lessons that we can learn from what the UK did and didn't do, besides pricing? And maybe that's it, Perry. Maybe it's just the pricing that is the mechanism that would make this better. But is it just pricing, or is there the detail that you need to make sure that it runs more effectively? And then the second part to this is, I know, so I like market forces dictating pricing, but because of the cap and trade, and my understanding it is market forces, there's a good chance, like in Europe, the price, it's actually dropped. So how do we move in the market? Are they planning to put a bottom on this in Ontario? I guess it's multiple questions, because if it's not working that well in Europe, why aren't we doing it differently, or how can we do it differently?
Right. Well, it's you could argue that putting a price on carbon is a tough sell at the best of times.
Yes.
And British Columbia, for instance, has done two things. I have relatives that live in BC, and you know, their life hasn't stopped because of the carbon tax. They're still doing the same things this year they were doing 5 years ago. But BC did two things that, you know, people in Ontario say can't be done. I mean, first they put a price on carbon. They taxed it.
Yep.
And the second thing is they got rid of the HST.
Yes.
Which I've been asked about too in a different venue. But here in Ontario, it's like, well, we don't like the HST, but there's nothing we can do about it. Well, BC found a way around that. They just said no HST, and that's not going to happen. So what BC's doing is showing that you can put on a carbon tax. And by doing that, the government then has direct control over the price of carbon.
Right.
Now, from a business perspective, and I work in a business school, so from a business perspective, you like to see market forces at work. So if you're primarily driven by market forces, you would say, well, I prefer to have some sort of market mechanism.
Right.
Now, the problem, there's multiple problems, as I'm sure you can imagine. The first problem is the allocation of permits.
Yes.
And the permits are supposed to be allocated based on a historical average of emissions per company. But in order not to scare off participants, typically more allocations are provided than are actually needed. And so the supply side of the market gets flooded relative to demand, and that pushes the price of carbon down. And that's basically the problem that Europe's been having. Yeah, there's too many carbon permits. They're not valuable.
So is that a lesson that our Ontario government needs to be really conscious of, or is it politically impossible for them to do that?
No. They've made a decision to go this way. They're not worried about the politics. The premier's here for 4 years. She has a majority. Now's the time to do it.
Right.
Right? So the thing is they need to be aware that they can't flood the market with too many permits, otherwise the price will fall. And that's one of the issues. Now, California, what they did is they put in a price floor. So the lowest price in the market is dictated by the floor, which is at $10 per metric ton. So California, of course, has learned from Europe as well, and they said, well, we're not going to let the price of carbon go down to 7 or 5 or, well, in Europe it was down to $4 per ton for a while. It's just ridiculously low. So they're going to put in a floor, and I suspect that Ontario will probably do both of those. They'll try to limit, ration the allocations of the permits, and they'll also put in a floor, and that'll help alleviate some of the pricing pressure on the downside.
In California, is there a plan to bump up that floor year after year?
Well, there is. The biggest problem right now is they're going to include the fuel wholesalers. See, when these plans, cap and trade, start out, typically the first round includes the electricity generators and some big industrial power users. But the fuel wholesalers are generally exempt. So, for instance, if you ask, well, what's the effect been of carbon pricing in California on gasoline prices, the answer is nothing, because the fuel wholesalers haven't had to be part of this. Now, this year, the big challenge is to get the fuel wholesalers into carbon trading. And the same thing, by the way, in Quebec, because this year Quebec is also going to require the fuel wholesalers. So now, once they're involved, you're going to start to see an impact on gas prices. And I think California is going to leave the floor as is and see how this works when they add in the fuel wholesalers.
So they think that's going to impact the supply-demand.
Well, what it should do is drive demand up.
Yeah.
And you shouldn't have to worry about the floor.
Right.
So, I mean, the best-case scenario is the floor is going to become not binding. It's not going to become an issue. And you only need to get started.
If I could just interject so I'm clear here, they're bringing new parties in under the plan or under the scheme.
Yeah.
But they're not issuing new permits.
Oh, no, they have to issue new permits because ideally every business gets an allocation based on the historical average of CO2 emissions.
I see.
Okay, but you have touched on another issue. If California floods the market with too many permits,
right,
we're back to the floor. So the tricky balance is you don't want to scare people off and have large political groups lobbying government, but on the other hand, you have to have the carbon price bite. And, you know, I've been following this whole issue since 1992, the Rio Summit, Kyoto Accord, and, you know, quite honestly, it's frustrating because we're just not moving fast enough if we actually want to do something to reduce CO2 emissions.
Perry, what you're saying, if our intent is actually to make things happen quicker, what do we need to do in a cap and trade for that to occur?
Well, unfortunately, there's not much you can do to speed it up because there's a learning process involved. It involves not only the government in setting the appropriate cap and allocating the emissions, but there's also a whole sub-industry that's going to be created. It's also good for the banks because there'll be carbon finance aspects. They'll have to have a market for this. There'll be the buying and selling of carbon on the marketplace. So potentially it creates a whole new sub-industry, but everybody involved in the industry has to have time to learn.
And what is that learning curve, you think?
Well, the European Union's been at it since 2005, so that would be 10 years. Well, basically, it's not working too well.
So they've learned it doesn't work.
Yeah, I don't mean to be facetious there, but they're learning what's not working. And I don't think we want to spend 10 years here in Ontario repeating the same type of mistakes or have the same kind of problems.
Especially if the government truly is serious about carbon reduction.
Right.
Right?
Right. Actually, you know, given that they already have issued a green bond, and they're going to do more green bond issues as well, Ontario would, I think, be better off with a carbon tax because they could just implement it through their normal fiscal measures. You don't have to, deal with all these issues about pricing and price floors and allocations. Carbon tax wouldn't be so good for your business, mind you, and I understand that. But, I mean, if you wanted to go quickly, the tax is a quicker approach. And I think that's what BC had in mind, too. They said, look, we don't want to spend 10 years learning about this. We just want to make it happen. And so tax is the way to make it happen.
Is it possible, because they've talked about cap and trade, can they all of a sudden talk about cap and trade and then all of a sudden revert to a carbon tax? Is that possible?
No, I don't think it is. I think once the commitment has been made, it's hard enough to sell the commitment. And I think if a government changes its mind, it's being viewed as weak and indecisive and flip-flopping.
Yeah.
And people won't take it seriously. No, I don't think so. I mean, the Ontario government's been talking about cap and trade now for, well, at least 5 or 6 years off and on, and they've never really made a strong commitment. And we still don't know what the details are, but at least there's a letter of intent signed with Quebec. So, you know, we're farther ahead now than we have been, and because of that, I don't think you're going to see us go carbon tax. I mean, I don't think they'd do that. It would create a lot of perceptions of indecision, and that's not good.
So when we look at California and Quebec in the last 2 years, is there measurable progress that constituents can go, okay, it's working or it's not working? Because transparency in this whole thing is really critical, isn't it?
Well, by progress, do you mean carbon emissions?
Yes.
No, it's too early to give any sort of definite indication. California, the government reports about a 2% reduction in CO2 emissions over the past 2 years, which they attribute to carbon trading. The difficulty is it's very hard to separate out the business cycle effects from the actual policy effects.
Right.
And, you know, a longer term would be Europe. We're probably looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of 7% CO2 reduction over 10 years. Is that all due to carbon trading? Well, probably not. I mean, they had very generous feed-in tariffs, subsidies for renewable energy at the same time. Very difficult to answer that question. So, no, I can't answer it definitively for you. We have to wait and see what happens. You know, any program that was started before, you know, the global recession, 2009, one of the effects was a reduction in economic activity, and emissions go down.
Yes.
Right? So, you know, how do you account for that? How do you factor that out? That's sort of the problem that we have when we look at the data is we get stuck in the recession. And now coming out of the recession, well, California tends to be relatively more efficient, lower energy intensity probably than many of the other states. So they already have a better mindset to this. And so about 2% reduction, but it's very hard to know if that's directly due to the carbon tax or not. And the other thing, again, is remember, the fuel wholesalers were exempt. We'll learn more in the coming years.
So Bob and I were fortunate enough to have an interview with Minister Glenn Murray.
Oh, good.
Yeah. He seemed to indicate that they are going to be chasing the oil and gas guys fairly quickly. It'd be interesting, like you're saying, in California, taking time before they're doing that.
Well, they move pretty quickly. I mean, it's year three, and they're at the end of the fuel wholesalers, right? So, you know, that 2 years of just electricity generation, heavy industrialized users, and then year three, bang, we're going after the fuel wholesalers. Same thing as in Quebec. They're moving pretty quickly. Good to hear that your understanding is that Ontario is going to do the same thing. So by 3 years in, we'll have the major CO2 emitters into the cap and trade system. We'll learn a lot more faster that way.
So if you don't mind me just interjecting, Glenn Murray also made reference to BC, Ontario, Quebec, and Alberta trying to develop a coordinated approach to pricing carbon sometime this year prior to going to Paris in December. So now Alberta might actually, well, it remains to be seen what's going to happen in Alberta, but assuming incoming government had campaigned on action on climate and probably be open to this, where do you see coordination between, or how could this be coordinated so that Ontario, Quebec, Saskatchewan, Alberta are all kind of aligned if they're not in all in the same cap and trading system?
Yeah.
You follow me? You know, how do you
How do you blend that in?
Well, I don't think that anyone is thinking about the blending in answer. I think what they're trying to do is get everybody back on the table. Now, I don't know what's going to happen in Alberta, except that they're going to pay more prices for a lot of things. That query is going to happen. And the giveaways of the natural resource space to the multinational oil companies is coming to an end. Corporate taxes are going to rise. They're going to have to pay more oil royalties and things like that. So within that mix, clearly it's not going to be difficult to press for carbon initiatives. So the first stage, I think, is to get everybody on the same page and say, look, here's something we want to talk about. Now, the odd one out, as you pointed, is BC, because they've gone carbon tax. But, you know, at least they've got an initiative. So the answer is, I don't know how they're going to make this all happen, because I don't think BC has any intention of trading carbon.
Right.
And really, you want more players to participate to get a bigger market, so you have more flexibility in the market. The concern is that Quebec and Ontario, you know, they're small compared to California, which has, you know, the state of California's GDP is as large as the entire country of Canada, right? So the economic activity is just so much greater in California. So if we can get more participation from our provinces, then this would help to flush out a better market. That's basically, I think, what they're talking about.
Right. And in Alberta, we have the SGER, Specified Gas Emissions Regulations.
Right.
And that's $15 per ton. So it's somewhere bumping around where California and Europe is doing it.
Yeah, 15 puts it right at Quebec right now. So, you know, they're in line in that with respect to that. The bigger issue is $15 a ton. There's not enough incentive on economic activity to really make much of a change in behavior when it comes to CO2 emissions. I know there's lots of complaining, but the fact is it's not having a big impact. If we want to see a big impact on CO2 emissions from carbon trade, the price has got to be a lot higher than $15 per metric.
It's interesting when you look at the, and I forget, it's the Executive Council. I think it's made up of CEOs across Canada. I don't know if you have any interaction with them, but they've been asking for something so they can understand what they need to do going forward. Have you had any discussions with them on...
No, I haven't. If a company's forward-looking and proactive, what they want to do is be at the table where the discussions are taking place. And they, you know, business hates uncertainty. So if you're going to, you know, put a price on carbon, okay, I can't fight you. You know, my favorite politician didn't get elected. I still got to do business. Please tell me what we need to do.
Yep.
So clearly that would be the response from business. Now, within companies, there's proactive and there's, you know, not so active, and then there's sandbaggers that just say, well, we're just going to block everything.
Yep.
Now, what Quebec's going to do, or what they're doing now, they're basically saying, look, these are the industries that are affected by the cap and trade, and if you don't comply, we're going to pursue legal action against you. This is going to be like not paying your taxes.
Right.
Right? We're going to come after you. The province is going to say, look, you didn't pay your carbon fees or whatever, or you didn't provide an energy audit on time, we're going to charge you for this. You're going to have to be held responsible. So there has to be legal bite to these kinds of plans. You can't just let industry, you know, sort of run this on their own because their incentives may not be aligned with what the government's objectives are.
Right.
Can't be voluntary.
No, it can't. It has to be mandatory. There has to be teeth. There has to be a police person. There has to be some sort of repercussions if there's mismanagement or mistakes are made or whatever. There has to be a legal system that bites to make this, you know, credible.
So do they have that in Quebec and California?
They do for the most part, and, you know, there hasn't been any, you know, gross negligence or offenders so far. I mean, California tends to be much more progressive in this thinking anyway, you know, so they don't complain as much. Quebec, I think, for the most part, you know, right now, Hydro-Quebec, you know, the heavy industrial users, nickel, aluminum companies, they're the ones that are participating right now. And they're basically complying with the rules of engagement.
But if you look at Quebec, because majority of their electricity is hydraulic,
yep.
You know, they're in a very sweet spot on that side. I think it would just be the oil and gasoline that would be or natural gas that would be a factor to them, right? And then if I look at Ontario, if we look at carbon per kilowatt hour, again, we're not as good as certainly Quebec or BC, but we're certainly better than Germany on our carbon for electricity. So it seems to me the emphasis will be, and you can please correct me, the emphasis will have to be, if we're looking at CO2, is the other fuels.
Yeah, well, I agree with you totally. And Ontario is in a pretty nice spot, too, because we were able to retire those coal-fired power generators. And remember, like, our biggest components for electricity generation are hydro,
yes,
and nuclear.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
We have the nuclear option.
Yes.
And that's one of the things that when I do cross-country comparisons around the world, you know, we can do analysis and show sensitivities, but in terms of substitutability, if you're talking about a country that doesn't have access to hydro on a large scale or nuclear, it's very hard to substitute away from fossil fuels. Coal is about all they have,
right,
or they all have access to.
Right.
So here in Ontario, you know, we have that advantage because we've got the nukes working, we've got hydro, we've got a little bit of natural gas, and as you pointed out, Quebec, you know, a lot of hydro. BC, same thing, a lot of hydroelectricity in BC, right? They never did have to worry about coal.
Right.
So those are the sort of the easy ones, jurisdictions, then they're the ones most likely to move forward with this because they don't have a big pushback from the fossil fuel business. Now, Quebec's going to find out what things are like because the fuel refineries, Quebec, Suncor, Valero, Irving, they're all going to be included in this year. So we'll see how they deal with this over the next year or so.
Now, one thing that I'm interpreting on this cap and trade, it really is going after large users and not sending signaling to the residential or
general
wholesale, consumer.
Retail, commercial, things like that.
Yeah, and my concern with cap and trade is just going to be large guys that have an understanding and exposure, but it's really not going to get understood by or appreciated by the Joe public. Is that true, or?
Yes, that's one very strong possibility. But you know, once your big fuel wholesalers are involved, then it feeds down throughout the fuel chain.
Okay.
Right, and so the higher prices. So if they have to pay higher prices for cap and trade, and remember the cap has to work by being reduced every year.
Right.
Right. Otherwise, there's no point doing this. So every year the cap has to fall. So that puts pressure on companies to, you know, be better at reducing their emissions, more technological advancement, more efficiency. But some of that cost is going to get pushed down the value chain, and yes, gasoline prices will go up.
So we may see, when we see at the pump where they break down the price per liter, they may show what the possible costs are because of the cap and trade.
Yeah, that's right. They have little stickers. They have HST, federal surcharge,
right.
And then provincial taxes or something.
Right.
I'm just trying to think. I was just there a couple of days ago at an Esso station here close to where I live, and they have a little sticker saying, you know, this is the taxes. So, yeah, they'll have a third category, you know, your carbon tax or whatever.
Right.
Now, the carbon tax in BC, so far, it's pushed up gas prices by about 6 cents a liter over 5 years. I mean, if you're talking about gasoline at $1.20 a liter, I mean, 1 or 2 pennies is not really that much.
Right.
Right now, of course, gas prices are much lower, but, you know, I mean, that, you know, prices fluctuate. So California is probably looking at about 10 cents a gallon over about 10 years.
Okay,
so if you want to get a rough ballpark of what it would be. And, you know, if gas prices go up 1 cent a gallon a year, the average motorist is never even going to notice it.
Agree.
Right?
Agree.
So, yeah, there'll be follow-through. The pricing pressure will be there, but it won't be very much. Now, you can turn this around, and you can also say, well, if that's the only effect on gasoline prices, then it must mean that the carbon market isn't pricing carbon high enough.
Right.
Right? Because if that's the only effect, then, you know, it's having very little impact on the average user. It means the price is too low.
So, which again, is a political choice, political decision, and they are reluctant. You still come back to political will, whether it's a cap and trade or a tax. It still comes back to the feet of government, and they're reluctant to maybe really put it where it needs to be. The political will isn't there.
Yeah, well, and if you want an example, you know, British Columbia was very quick. They, out of the gate, they started off with $10 per metric ton. It quickly rose to $30, which is where it's at now. But there are no further plans to raise the carbon tax in BC.
Right.
And so they're at $30, which is, you know, better than 15, but that's not enough to have a really big impact. So, you know, their political will must be wearing thin, at least in their view, because they don't seem to want to push it to a higher price.
So let's. I'm just thinking. I mean, we're undertaking this process. The intent of undertaking this process is really to reduce carbon because it's felt that there's a significant problem. What I'm hearing you say is that actually it's not moving and not moving quick enough. But assuming that everyone understands that we do need to move quicker. How do you expedite this process based on the things that they currently have in place? So just make sure everyone understands what I'm saying. We go through this, but we say we need to achieve a certain target. We don't come close to it. How do you advance it based on what you already have in place? What's the mechanism that you do government-wise?
Well, I mean, the advantage of a cap and trade is if you want a higher price on carbon and you want more carbon reductions, just lower the cap. Right, the cap is set every year, so, and the government sets the cap. So whatever, you know, megatons of emissions they have, just lower it by 2 or 4% a year, or 5% if that's what they want to do, and then scale back the allocations to the companies proportionally, and then let them go to the marketplace and make up the difference.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
And that's the advantage of cap and trade. Is you say, okay, you know what, we're not moving fast enough. Let's lower that cap by 7% from last year. Okay, everybody's allocations are lowered by 7%, and all of a sudden a lot of companies are saying, well, we don't have enough permits to emit. Well, go to the marketplace. All of a sudden carbon's trading at $50 a ton.
How far in advance do they give end users that notice?
Oh, lots of time.
Yeah?
Yeah,
lots. Well, what does that mean, Perry, when you say lots of time? Is that years in notice or what?
Ideally, the whole thing should work the same way as your taxes do. There should be a fiscal year where you have to produce evidence of your emissions and how much you bought in credits or how much you sold, and then you'll have sort of the next year's allocation will already be decided many months, 6-7 months in advance, 9 months in advance.
Because if you think about it, if these people have to do something, whether it's do something internally or buy credits, they need to budget for that.
Yes, and that's one of the complaints. So
right.
Business hates uncertainty. Tell us in advance what's going to happen over the next 10 years so we can
budget accordingly.
Now, typically what happens is the credits, the carbon credits, once they're allocated to a company, they can be rolled over to future years.
Right.
Which can also cause a problem too, right?
Right.
Right? Because if you hit a big recession and economic activity goes down, business activity slows, well, everybody's sitting on this large excess supply of credits. Well, when business does start to resume, everybody's well covered. Carbon price plummets, again, because everybody's got too many credits.
Right.
Right? That's
what happened in Europe,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, that's what happened in Europe, right? They went into 2009 sitting on this big stack of carbon emissions credits, and then coming out of it, there's no incentive to buy anything because they have lots of extra credits.
So what do you do to change that?
Yeah, well, that's the problem is the first step is to get everybody familiar, get their feet wet. The second one is to throw them off the deep end and get everybody swimming, right?
Okay.
To use the analogy of, you know, the old school way of learning to swim. Basically, if the government wants these carbon emissions to be reduced in a substantial manner, they have to lower the cap, and that forces them to cut the amount of allocations that are out there. That's basically what the message is.
Okay. For our end users, what's the message that we need to tell them to prepare for this? What can you give us a list of things that they need to do to start preparing for this?
Well, first you have to decide whether or not you're in one of the industries that's going to be targeted up front, right?
Yeah.
If you're in one of the generation industries or if you're in the industrial usage industry, first thing is, well, basically what your company does. They're going to have to do some benchmarking and find out what their emissions are. Usually they use some sort of an average over the last 3 or 5 years to allocate the emissions quotas per company, so you have to have a benchmark. And then companies will have to budget for the possibility that if they exceed their quota, they'll have to go to the market and pay extra dollars, which, as you said, will have to come out of their budget. So, within the budgeting benchmarking area, those are two important things. And then are there any sort of efficiency aspects that they might want to look at that maybe they hadn't looked at before because they didn't think it was worthwhile? But now, if you're going to have to pay for extra carbon emissions, maybe there's a way of retooling how the energy usage is being conducted. So they'll look at conservation and efficiency aspects.
Okay.
Okay?
Yep. Now, great list. So I'm going to two things I want to bring to your or ask you. So one of the challenges we have in our business is that, I spoke earlier that it typically goes to one department, normally technically oriented when we're talking about energy efficiency. And we're trying to get and drive this knowledge base to the financial people that tend to just think energy, once you put it under a budget, you don't have to worry about it anymore. With what you're describing, is it possible, who's actively, from your experience and research, does the financial group get much more involved in energy issues now with this cap and trade?
Yeah, because it's going to be a budgeting issue, as you pointed out. There's going to have to be some understanding that if we're going to participate in carbon, unless we're absolutely certain that we can always emit under our cap, unless that's the case, we're probably going to have to at some point participate in the market. We need to have some understanding and some knowledge of what's going on.
Okay.
And that'll help link down to the energy efficiency because, if you're over the cap by a small amount, you can say, well, gee, can't we just dial down the thermostat a little bit? I mean, what happened there? Isn't there something we can do to just make a small tweak to this? Or is this, going to be a major overhaul for the way we conduct our energy usage?
So it's possible this is going to do what we're trying to do with customers, is get more integration.
I would say this is probably a good motivator for companies to get involved in thinking about integrating an energy strategy.
Right.
I certainly agree with you. Most businesses, you know, they just don't really think about it. They know it's a cost, but you know what? It's just not a big deal. We have to pay for it, and away we go. But this will force companies to think more closely about this, and so energy management becomes more integrated with the strategic focus of the organization.
I think for us, this idea of being able to be provide our customers with some basic knowledge and some ideas of things they could do, steps they could need to be taking now to adjust to a cap and trade market, just helping them understand the basic principles is an excellent first step. As you say, as I took from our interview, you saying this takes a while for everybody to figure out how this market should work and gain some experience. It takes a bit of time to do that, and before you can start to really make it achieve the GHG emission reductions that you want.
You know, one of the things that's going to come up here in Ontario is people are probably going to start wondering, well, wait a minute, we have all this Green Energy Act, all this renewables going into the electrical grid. You know, does that exempt me, my business, from all this carbon stuff or what? And, you know, the answer is, well, no, it doesn't. I'm sure there's going to be confusion with that down the road, because there was some confusion in Europe a few years ago, too, about that. But, you know, if you're a company that's a heavy user of energy, well, you've got to measure your CO2 emissions. That's basically what it means.
Perry, just one last question that I have,
sure.
Because of what Glenn Murray had to say, and that is, you know, Ontario is heavily reliant on the automotive sector, and there was thought that that they wanted to try to encourage a different form of transport, using electrification for transportation. From the work you've seen in Europe and also in California, has that impacted the transportation industry to go towards more green tech? I mean, you can talk about Tesla, but I'm not sure that was a California-driven scenario or what. But could we see that could encourage a different form of transportation in Ontario because of this?
Well, I think my answer overall is yes. But when you're talking about the major multinational auto makers, you know, they look at a global portfolio, and clearly, you know, they're all interested very much either in hybrids or electric vehicles. And so to some extent, this has already started. I mean, there already is electrification of transportation. Ontario's first green bond is going for an LRT project, right? So clearly there's that move towards electrification. But that, and this is a topic for another time, but that brings up a question too, because, you know, you feel good if you buy a car that's electric powered because, you know, you're not burning fossil fuels. And in Ontario, you're probably not, because the next question is, how was the electricity generated?
Yeah, was it a gas generator?
Yeah, right. Now, here in Ontario and Quebec and BC, well, we're, you know, heavy hydroelectric. Ontario, we've got the nuclear power component. So, you know, overall, it's going to have a huge impact. So if we have more electric cars in Ontario, it's going to be a great benefit to reducing our CO2. And really, of the provinces, Alberta is going to be the odd one out. But, you know, new leader, new premier, things are going to change quickly, I suspect. But so what we want in Ontario, if you want to talk about manufacturing, what we want to do is we want to actually start making electric vehicles here.
Yes, that's the sense we got.
Yeah, so not only get people driving them, but we actually want to start making them.
Yes.
Right.
Bob, do you have any other questions that you might have for Perry?
Not questions, but just how much I appreciate it. Description and explanation. And I think certainly for us, in writing an article for our readers, I can see how you've been very, very helpful in doing that, and you communicate it very well, so appreciate it.
Okay. Well, look, on behalf of Bob and I, it's been great talking to you, and thank you so much, Perry.
Okay.
Thank
have a great day.
Okay, you guys too. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.